for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Every year, hundreds of thousands of people have hip replacement surgery. Artificial hip devices usually last about 15 to 20 years. But lawsuits against the maker of a once popular type of artificial hip are raising some new questions about the procedure in general. Joining me to talk about hip replacement surgery, Diana Zuckerman of the National Research Center for Women and Families, Dr. Henry Boucher, an orthopedic surgeon at MedStar Union Memorial Hospital in Baltimore, Maryland, joining us from a studio in New York, Barry Meyer of the New York Times, and Sarah Brown is also here. She'll provide a patient's perspective. And I know many of you will want to join us. Give us a call, 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to have you all with us. Barry Meyer, I'd like to start with you. I know you've been covering the trial that's going on regarding hip implants. Give us the background.
Sure, Diane. Well, first of all, the trial involves a device made by a unit of Johnson & Johnson that's no longer sold. And this particular device, which used metal components, began fouling at a significant rate soon after it was implanted into people. The data started building up. Johnson & Johnson kept selling it nonetheless. And eventually in 2010, the company recalled the device. The big problem with it is that the metal components would shed metallic debris, which could get into people's muscles, tissues, bones, and set off reactions that would destroy tissue and actually leave some of them crippled and in a terrible state. I think the bigger issue that you pointed to in your introduction is, why did this product get onto the market, and what do patients who need this procedure, which, as you noted, is an extremely effective procedure, what kind of information should they be armed with when they go to talk to a doctor about having a hip replacement?
So you've now got something like 10,000 lawsuits by patients who got one of these devices, and they're in trial now. Is that correct?
That's correct, Diane.
And
the first case just started.
When were these devices first used?
The ones that were used in patients here in the United States were used in 2005. There was a predecessor device that used similar components that was sold overseas in 2002 for the first time, I believe. And by 2007, Johnson & Johnson's orthopedic unit was getting reports from its own consultants that this thing was problematic. It was failing. And the trial now has shown that they actually started a project to redesign a critical component of the device, but then dropped it because they determined that the sales of the product didn't justify the costs of apparently correcting the problem.
Help me to understand how patients and how doctors began to first learn not just that the device was failing, but that something was going on within the patient's body to signify that something bad was happening, Barry.
Well, the first sign of a problem with a hip replacement is pain. I mean, the person starts to have the type of pain that is the type of pain in some ways that they experience before they need a hip replacement.
Sure.
So they're experiencing pain in their hip joint. It's difficult for them to walk. And they come back to the doctor and they say to the doctor, hey, I just got a new hip a year or two ago. What's going on? The doctor's also puzzled because they believe this thing shouldn't be malfunctioning or the patient shouldn't have pain. That's not their intent. And so eventually some doctors began to look for reasons, try to better understand what was happening. So they would do tests like drawing fluid. You know, take a needle and they pull out some fluid by the patient's hip, and they would see this kind of dark gray gunk that really was the reaction of the metal debris interacting with the patient's tissue and creating what essentially was a discharge.
Did that metal debris cause other problems within the body?
That is sort of a central question that, unfortunately, there's not great evidence about one way or another. That is to say, are these local problems, local to the hip? And they can be quite significant because they can damage tissue and bone to the point where it's difficult to implant another replacement. But, you know, there are concerns that they may cause cancer, may cause kidney failure, may cause a host of other ills. But we really don't know the answer to that because this is the first kind of widespread experiment where, you know, hundreds of thousands of people were implanted with these devices.
Barry Meyer, he's staff reporter for the New York Times, author of Painkiller, A Wonder Drug's Trail of Addiction and Death. Turning to you, Diana Zuckerman, what's the FDA doing about these problems?
To start with, the FDA did not require any clinical trials, any studies of humans on these metal-on-metal hips or any hips prior to letting them be sold. So I know that's shocking.
It's shocking.
It's shocking.
How did these companies get around the FDA?
Actually, about 95% of all medical devices, including implanted devices, are not required to be studied in clinical trials before they were sold if they're considered similar to something else that's already for sale.
And, for example?
Another hip that had been sold prior that might have been made out of a different material, made by a different company, might have a different shape, might actually look quite different. But this is true for, you know, for some cardiac devices, for many other devices. So hips are just one terrible example of a device that was considered not serious enough, not high risk enough to be required to do clinical trials until the kinds of problems that Barry just mentioned were found. And then the FDA responded by saying, maybe we really do need studies. And so now the FDA is saying that the companies that want to continue to sell metal-on-metal hips must do studies, and that any new companies coming in must do studies before they can sell their product. But this is only for metal-on-metal hips, not for all the other kinds of hips that are still being sold.
Isn't there also a question of exactly what the FDA found on January 17th in regard to the metal shards traveling within the body?
Well, they've been requiring studies to look at these metal, looking at the metal debris and what the risks are. And, you know, as has been mentioned, there's concern about carcinogens. There's concern about neurotoxic effects. There are a lot of concerns about these. But in the meantime, these products are in people's bodies and, you know, surgeries being done that will still have new patients getting these new products, I mean, these older products.
Diana Zuckerman, she's president of the National Research Center for Women and Families. Dr. Henry Boucher, welcome. How long do artificial hips normally last?
Well, standard will tell patients about 15 years. So, you know, just getting into this whole metal-on-metal hip issue a little bit more, you have to go back to the history a little bit more of total hip replacement. Some of the total hip replacements in the 1950s were metal-on-metal, and they're made out of cobalt and chromium, which is the alloy that's used in these devices. So the metal shards we're talking about are actually ion release from the wear, and clearly, they can cause local problems in a percentage of patients. I don't disagree with anything that Mr. Meyer said. And there is actually a silver lining to it, is that it's actually made us much better at how we handle patients with a painful hip arthroplasty. And just in general, we have we're developing better tests for patients with pain to diagnose what's going on soft tissue-wise around a hip replacement. So even metal on plastic hips can still have problems. And that's not to scare patients. By and large, hip replacement is an excellent, long-lasting procedure that really improves the quality of their life. But there has been numerous studies throughout the past 10 to 20 years of metal-on-metal hips that were done in Europe that actually performed quite well. And I would have to assume that that's why they took off, because it gave the promise that they wouldn't wear out in 15 years.
So despite these lawsuits, and there are many, are doctors still using these same kinds of devices?
I would say no. So if back in 2005 to 2007, metal-on-metal hips were 30% of the market. They were very hot for in my arena for doing hip replacements. We really thought they would be better for patients. And I would add that not all implants are the same. We're talking about one particular device. They're manufactured differently. They behave differently. Not that you still can't have some of the same reactions with any metal-on-metal device. But at this point, I would say much less than it's maybe a percent or two are still doing metal-on-metal. I can't think of anybody that would be with what's going on out there. And that's a difference between hip resurfacing, which is a different animal. But I would say metal-on-metal total hip replacement is no longer being done.
Dr. Henry Bouger, he's an orthopedic surgeon at MedStar Union Memorial Hospital in Baltimore, Maryland. When we come back, you'll hear from someone who's had numerous hip replacements. Stay with us. And welcome back. We're talking about hip replacement surgery. More than 300,000 Americans have had hip replacement surgery, and that was last year alone. That number is growing. People do seem to have problems with hips, causing great pain, leading to an inability to really put any weight whatsoever on that hip and end up having surgery, which can work fine in some cases. How about for you, Sarah Brown? You have had three hip replacement surgeries. Tell us why.
Well, I had my first one, my left hip replaced when I was 44 and had three relatively young children. And for me, it was a remarkably wonderful and successful event. I was in excruciating pain, and rather suddenly, and I mean almost within a day of the operation, I felt this gnawing pain go away. And I had a very good recovery and went back to a fully normal life, working, carpool, traveling, so forth. About 8 years later, I had to have more work done on it because I was one of those people who had a plastic liner as opposed to metal on metal. It was metal on plastic. And it turned out the plastic degrades a bit too, little bits and pieces. So I had what's called a revision where the plastic was taken out and a different plastic put in. again, with not an enormous amount of long-term data. So far, so good, though. Here I am now, total 20 years out from the original. And then about 10 years ago, I had the other hip replaced. So I've had two on the left and one on the right. My experience in general has been very good. I've been one of the probably, 85 to 90% of people who say it's made a huge difference in my life. I would have been in a wheelchair in my mid-40s with young children. But it is also true what we've been talking about today about the confusion and the fear and the misinformation. You know, we talk so much now in this era of healthcare reform about informed patients, how patients are supposed to learn everything and then make decisions. This is an area that I think is unusually difficult. You not only have cost issues, which I think we'll get to later, how much does it cost? You have to talk to people about minimally invasive versus the old way, which is much more dramatic. You can talk about hip resurfacing versus replacement. And then you can talk about the type of device. And the average bear simply doesn't have, I could spend 2 weeks trying to figure this out.
Sure.
And I'm sure I'll have to have something more done every, a few years I get the fan belt fixed. But the notion that individual people can figure this out on their own strikes me as unreasonable. But again, I've had a great experience. I understand there are a number of people who've had terrible suffering, infection, and all these issues we're talking about.
Sarah, one question. How athletic were you and are you?
I've never been a great athlete, unlike my family members, but I've always was very active in sort of gym things and basic aerobic training, and I've been able still to this day to do that. I came from the gym to this show. It hurts, but that's partly getting older, and I also have spinal problems and so forth. But a good hip replacement, which I've experienced, really does allow people to go back to quite normal life, which for me was thrilling.
Sarah Brown, she's CEO of the National Campaign to Prevent Teen and Unplanned Pregnancy. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Diana Zuckerman, coming back to you, this challenge that Sarah has talked about, if I were coming to a doctor like Dr. Boucher, who has a fine reputation, I'm suffering, I need a new hip, what am I going to know to ask him?
That is such a tough question. And to me, what I would most like patients to be able to ask and doctors to be able to answer would be, as a woman, is there a particular kind of hip replacement that's better for me? Is there a certain kind of material that you think is better? One of the things that isn't talked about much is the fact that women tend to have a worse outcome with hip replacements. They
tend to have more hip failures? Men?
Well, that's partly because they're older. So women are more likely to be patients, but they're also more likely to need revisions more quickly. And we don't know why that is. It's partly the shape of the women's hip, but it may partly be for other reasons, maybe because the design is better for men and not as good for women of many hip replacements. So the bottom line is if you have all these different kinds, you'll have all these different companies making all these different models of hips. Wouldn't it be terrific if they were studied, some of them before they were sold, studied in humans, but certainly all of them afterwards, so that you could say, okay, for young athletic women, these hips tend to be a little better. For older couch potatoes, these other hips tend to be better. For people who are overweight, this might be better. For thin people, this might be better. We have no data at all, none of that.
Dr. Boucher, what do you tell your male or female patients who come in about the various types? What would seem to work best for that individual?
Well, I try to engage them in the discussion because, just like Diana said, there's many different brands, and even within each brand, there are many different types. And it will be somewhat surgeon preference, but they should be able to explain their preference to the patient if they want to know. Some patients don't want to know. So the choice is left up to us and our best judgment of what we think will work the best.
But now, surely, many of your patients now and your prospective patients have heard about these lawsuits.
Absolutely.
Doesn't that make them ask more questions?
Sure. It's created much more time in the office with patients to explain those issues because they're frightened, because they see these lawsuits.
I don't blame them.
Well, I don't either. And, you know, but it is something that we need to talk about. And just in general, hip replacement is still an excellent, safe procedure that really improves the quality of patients' lives. And I try to tailor what I do to the patient. So there are implants that I think may be better for a certain type of bone. I somewhat disagree with that we don't have studies out there. There are great long-term studies about different types of stems that are out there that work in men and women.
Stems?
Stems is, I'm sorry, they are the implant that goes into the femur, and that's what we're talking about. The socket is a round socket that fits into the pelvis. There's really not much male-female. There is some differences in anatomy that can happen case by case, but we're really talking about the femoral implant part that goes in the femur.
Barry Meyer, talk about the reaction to the articles you've written about these lawsuits.
Sure. Well, I mean, I think the lawsuits and the discussion we're having today sort of addresses a broader issue as well. And that is, you know, why did surgeons like Dr. Boucher, and I'm not saying picking on him individually, but why did they embrace these implants without any data in hand? It's correct to say that they thought they were going to work better, and they believed, based on some very preliminary data, that they were going to work better. But there was really no actual practical data. So they basically took this on a wing and a prayer, and we're seeing the results of that today. A number of companies have set up implant registries where they actually track the outcomes of patients who receive these devices. And based on those registries, they tailor their practices. We still do not do that in the United States. We are the largest consumer of these devices throughout the world, but we've sort of dragged our feet in creating the type of data that would be useful to both Dr. Boucher and to patients in determining what is the appropriate device for them to have.
That's really a good point. I'm just wondering, Dr. Boucher, when a patient does have problems, what kind of obligation are you under to report that problem, whether it's the shards or whether it's the hip is failing earlier than it should? Under what obligation are you to the FDA?
Well, there is no definite obligation, but there is a website where you can go on and register a implant-related complication. So that's something that you can do. It is somewhat voluntary. Some of the companies, as they track their outcomes now, you know, they would like to get their hands on the implant, but quite frankly now, the implants with any of these cases go right to the attorneys.
Diana Zuckerman.
As is true for just about every kind of adverse reaction, even death, reporting is voluntary on the part of the doctors. I think it's an ethical responsibility. But once a report goes to the company is required to provide that report to the FDA.
And joining us now by phone from Atlanta, Georgia, Kenneth Thorpe. He's professor of public health at Emory University. Good morning to you, sir.
Well, good morning to you.
I know that in addition to all these reports about faulty artificial hip devices, we've also heard lots of questions about the variation in cost of hip replacement. What do we know about that variation?
Well, there's a dramatic variation both in the prevalence of hip replacements, so just the number of replacements done per 1,000 people varies fivefold throughout the country. And on the spending side, there is dramatic variation that is, you know, we don't fully understand it, but it's in part linked to the fact that the cost of providing surgical procedures in different types of hospitals do vary dramatically. So a major academic medical center compared to a community hospital is going to have a dramatic cost structure difference, and so the cost of a hip replacement would vary dramatically.
Interesting.
The other reason why they would
vary
is
that a study
like
published
the
in the Archives of Internal Medicine this spring found you can pay as little as $1,500 to as much as $182,000 for hip replacement surgery. How does that happen?
Well, again, I think that, you know, hospitals charge different amounts in part because they have different cost structures, and in part because depending on how much competition there is in a local market, they can get away with it or not. Even in our Medicare program, Medicare pays dramatically different amounts of money for hip replacements in different hospitals as a part of public policy.
But so, does that make sense to you?
Well, I mean, it does in a sense. I mean, it could vary by up to 75% from the low cost to the high cost, but it's in part related to the fact that if you're paying for a procedure at, let's say, George Washington University versus a community hospital in rural Pennsylvania, you know, the costs of running those operations are dramatically different, and that is reflected in what Medicare and other payers pay for health care services.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Sarah Brown.
Well, I think what Dr. Thorpe just said is very important, this huge range in cost. To me, though, as a consumer, it just reflects what we see all the time in the U.S. healthcare system. This hip implant issue is tragic and important in and of itself. But the notion that there's enormous geographic variation in procedures, that patients don't know much, that physicians vary in their preferences for different approaches to, you know, whatever it is, spinal fusion, abdominal surgery, it goes on and on. I think in some ways, we've been naive. We think, well, this is all science-based. It's all very rational. The cost is reflecting, and we have adequate data. I don't think in many areas of American medicine that's true. This one happens to be in high relief now, and I hope we understand it. But a lot of this is as confusing as we are discussing, many areas.
Barry Meyer, Dr. Thorpe talked about geographical differences. Is there apparently any difference in quality if one pays $180,000 versus $1,500?
Well, maybe in the quality of the food you get when you're in the hospital. Certainly not in the quality of the device. There's been studies made in Australia. One came out not long ago, a country that closely tracks device outcomes. And what they basically found is that, you know, newer devices, be it a new hip or a new knee, did not outperform older ones in terms of their longevity. So, you know, I think there's an important lesson to be learned from that, which is we have different incentives driving the costs of healthcare in this country, which are skyrocketing.
Well, and on the incentive question, I'm wondering whether patients should regularly be asking whether there's any relationship between the doctor and the company that makes that particular medical device. Barry?
Well, perhaps, yes. I mean, the patient should be most concerned with, is this device going to work best for me? The doctor should be most concerned with the question of, is this device going to work best for the patient? And again, we come back to the question of data. And until the patient is in a position to actually scrutinize the data, to understand the data, and the doctor himself or herself has the data, we're going to be kind of floating in this netherworld. Because, I mean, essentially, the imperative of the company is to keep iterating and producing new devices so it can justify cost increases for those devices. The imperative of the doctor is to try to find a new or better device that's going to work for the patient. But the question is this new product that the doctor is being shown and marketed to by the sales rep actually going to improve outcomes for their patients.
And, of course, that must be a question you're asking all the time, Dr. Boucher.
Absolutely. I'm well aware of the recent developments over the past 10 years in both hip and knee replacement. And, again, I don't disagree with what's been said. Some of the older devices have proven to be adequate for an excellent result and a long-term outcome. But with that said, is the patient population for this procedure continues to get younger. And so if we take a 55-year-old who might live to 90, I can't guarantee them that their implant's going to last forever.
Dr. Henry Boucher, he is at MedStar Union Memorial Hospital in Baltimore, Maryland. When we come back, your questions and comments.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Gilchrist Foundation, in support of NPR's commitment to coverage of the arts, by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR at advanced journalistic excellence in the digital age, by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need on the web at rwjf.org, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR.
California's Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom. He's been on the cutting edge of technology and social issues. The former San Francisco mayor on making government better in the digital age. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. It's time to open the phones for your questions. 800-433-8850. First to Louisville, Kentucky. Good morning, Joe. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. How you doing?
I'm good, thanks.
I've actually had my hip replaced three times. I would like to say that I basically blame myself for this, and the comment that I have are to the listeners out there that are thinking about getting their hip replaced. I'm in my late 50s. I've been very active in my life. I had a tremendous surgeon that put in a new hip for me, and I'll tell you, 3 days later, I felt like I was on top of the world. I just could not believe, you know, the remarkable recovery I had. However, 28 days later, I fell off my front porch swing and fractured my femur right below the stem, so they had to go back in and put in a longer stem, and that seemed to solve the problem, but then the stem broke, and so I've had that replaced. But my comment is to those people that are active and have this done. Even though the procedure goes extremely well and they feel great later, they have to understand that it is a major surgery and that the femur has been drilled into, and they really need to take care of themselves for a while.
What do you think, Dr. Boucher?
Well, I think that's exactly right. It is a major surgery, and patients come in, they want minimally invasive surgery, they want to be healed in a week or two, they want to be back to work, they want to cycle, they want to play tennis, and it's difficult to slow them down because they do feel, some of them feel very well within a short period of time. And so you do have to understand that you have to take that. It takes 6 weeks for bone to heal. It has to heal to the implant. You know?
But is it a little weakened by virtue of replacement? And do people who have these hip replacements need to take that into account?
Absolutely. That doesn't mean you can't gain back to relatively normal strength afterwards, but it doesn't happen in a week or two.
Go ahead, Sarah.
Well, I think this highlights another problem of the medical care system, the hips being just one example, which is the extent of counseling both before operations and after. People do an okay job, you know, the office, and some surgeons are quite communicative. But I suspect if we could do a survey, people would say, you know, I got some information, not a whole lot, and I didn't get an enormous amount of preparation for what it was really going to be like afterwards and the physical therapy and the length of recovery. One of the reasons, of course, is nobody gets paid for long, cozy conversations with patients. And so a lot of us, you know, talk to each other and we go online.
Sure.
But that's not the same as high-quality pre- and post-operative support.
Absolutely.
And education.
Diane.
Well, I think the other issue is the lack of information. And I can't say this enough. I've read every study that's been published on hips. And although there are studies and great registries in Europe, unfortunately, the way they do hip replacements in Europe tend to be different than here. They use cement in the hip replacement, which they do not use here. And so all the data on what works and how long it lasts in Europe is mostly useless for patients here. Mm. So if, you know, the discussion isn't really, you know, is it worth it to get hip replacement? By the time people get hip replacement, it's worth it.
Yeah,
for the
sure.
vast majority of
sure.
people, they need it. But if we had scientific research on human beings, by the way, most of the research that is given to the FDA are done in laboratories by robots. So they're moving a joint around many, many, many times, but it's not in a human body. So if we had the data to say, you know, some of these probably are better than others, and some are probably better for certain kinds of people than others, wouldn't it be important to know that so that the next time Sarah gets surgery, she can get
Let's
a hip
hope
that
she
lasts
does
longer?
Barry Meyer has all of this and the questions raised about hips and replacement hips. Has that cast light on other forms of replacement, for example, knees?
Sure. I mean, you know, the essential question comes back to which design and which method of implantation works best. And that is a question that people are trying to answer all the time, trying to gather data all the time. In Europe, actually, there is data that's relevant to, and in Australia, to patients here, because they do differentiate between different types of procedures that are done, whether they use cement or not. So, you know, there's a drive to better understand this. The question is, how's that data going to be embraced and improved upon and turned to the benefit of the patient? Surgeons like Dr. Boucher are doing the best for their patients. They certainly have the best intentions for their patients. But what kind of data do they have beyond their own subjective experience to guide them?
Exactly. All right, let's go to Medford, Oregon. Good morning, Milt.
Good morning, Diane. And first of all, thank you for your wonderful show.
Thanks.
You do a marvelous job in informing us and the public.
Thank you.
My point is not with the hip replacements, but with pacemakers. Approximately 10 years ago or so, I had a pacemaker put in because of atrial fib problems. I was having a lot of difficulty with it. And about 4 years later, on a routine examination by the factory rep, he was having problems adjusting it, so he called his company. The company told him that there had been a recall on this pacemaker because of an electrical short about a year earlier, and they had notified the cardiologist. The cardiologist, while I sat in the office here, checked the records, and they could not find any notification of it, which is fine. And I said, well, why wasn't I notified as the patient? It's my heart and my life that will extinguish if the thing fails completely. And they said, there's no requirement by the FDA to do that. They're only required to notify the doctor, and the doctor is supposed to notify the patient.
Diana.
Yeah, you can, if your toaster goes bad, you'll get a recall notice. If your hip goes bad or your pacemaker goes bad, the doctor will get it. What if the doctor died? What if the doctor retired? Or what if the doctor just isn't very well organized? Or you moved and they don't know where you are.
Barry, is that one of the issues that's come up in the lawsuit?
I don't think it's come up in the lawsuit per se, but the broader issue, as Diane Zuckerman pointed out, is pervasive throughout the use of these devices. That is to say, who should be the point of contact if there is a problem? Should be the doctor, who can sort of explain the situation to the patient, or should it be a letter that the patient gets and maybe freaks out when they get in, doesn't really know what to do. So it's sort of a complicated issue. I don't know what happened in the caller's case, whether there was a miscommunication between the company and the doctor, or the doctor just didn't follow up
on
it. All right,
so Dr. Boucher, have you had memoranda notifications from the companies or from the FDA about some of these devices, and do you then immediately call on the patient who may have one of these devices already implanted?
Absolutely. I think it's our obligation to do that, and it's difficult. It puts a huge strain on your practice, especially if you have many patients that went through the procedure. I fortunately did not have many patients that have gone through this whole recalled implant, but I do get notifications on a regular basis from companies that a certain product of theirs has a certain type of recall. And, I have to assess whether I've used that product in the past and who I've used it on. And sometimes that record may not exist because it may be 10 years ago. So I think that there has to be another foolproof way to notify patients, but they have to be notified. And I think the best person to notify them in reality is the physician that can explain what it means.
But
because it does,
as you say, it's going to put that much more of a burden on the doctor.
Absolutely.
And the practice. So how many patients have you implanted these metal-on-metal devices?
Probably less than a dozen.
And have they now all been informed that these lawsuits are taking place?
Well, they have been entered into a database from, they are instructed on what to do, and they go to the website, and they make contact with the company. And my obligation is to let them know what's going on and to follow them and do the proper testing on them to see if there's truly a problem that needs to be addressed.
But suppose they say, considering the risk that has been shown by these hundreds of thousands of people who are having difficulty, I want you to remove this and replace it.
I'm not convinced that's the best path, because I think some of these implants will function fine. And I think we have to provide objective evidence that there truly is a problem. So I think the patient has to be worked up with all the tests that we've had, or that we have now. And like I said, it's helped us to become better diagnosticians for painful arthroplasties in general. And then we have to make a decision. But a revision surgery is not a benign surgery. It's a big deal.
Sure.
And the complications go way up.
Okay.
So,
let's go to Alexandria, Virginia. Good morning, Sharon.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you so much for doing this.
Sure.
I had my original left hip implant on March the 24th, 2004. I was 58 years of age and weighed 102 pounds. I'd been in considerable pain. And about 2.5 to 3 years later, I developed a terrible rash, which eventually, and my cobalt levels went up to 136 or higher, and my eosinophils, or the white count, was very elevated, and I was miserable. And finally, I had a revision surgery on October 20th, 2010, and they took out a mass of metal debris. Almost a year later, I had developed fluid on it, actually about 8 or 9 months later, and that has been taken out once, and now I have fluid again. There was, of course, no metal testing before, and the allergist did find with the back test, the scratch test, that I was allergic to cobalt, and there was no other way to come in contact with it. My rash has become considerably better. My metal ion levels have decreased, but I'm still suffering from a great deal of pain.
Oh, I'm so sorry. That just sounds like a ghastly experience. Barry Meyer, are we also dealing here with allergies to metal, not only fragments sort of breaking off, but real allergies?
There seems to be some evidence that a number of people, a percentage of people, have these allergies to metals. It seems to be a higher rate among women than among men. I mean, they're women or people that will put on jewelry that contains metal and develop a skin allergy to it. So imagine now that the source of the allergic reaction is like constantly inside your body. And that seems to be the source of at least some of the problem. It's actually, there's a lot of research going on this. There's a question about whether people should be getting skin allergy tests before they receive certain types of implants. It's sort of cloudy right now. I mean, maybe Dr. Boucher has better current data on it than I do, but it is an area of interest.
All right, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Dr. Boucher.
So it's a difficult process to diagnose somebody with an allergy. So I think you can default, and if somebody says, I'm allergic to nickel or I have a known metal allergy, there are implants you can just place to avoid that. For instance, you pick an all-titanium implant and a ceramic ball on the plastic. Testing has been, to my knowledge, is really no accurate way to test for it. You can do the skin tests, which have not been that reliable. There is some blood testing that can be done, so sometimes patients will, I'll take some blood from them, send it off to a special lab, and they'll look for reactivity. But it's just like you said, it's a difficult problem to diagnose. So if anybody gives me an unusual history, I'm trying to go with the most hypoallergenic hip I can.
All right, and final call to Cape Cod, Massachusetts. Hi there, Tessa.
Hi, I called because I just want to let people know, in my case, I had no pain. I had a lump in my groin. About a year out, at the time I got the metal on metal hip, it felt great for about nine months. And then I got a lump in my groin. It just kept getting bigger, and I was doing Pilates at the time, and my hip started clunking a little bit. But so I went to my doctor, and he said my hip was perfect. He took an X-ray, said everything was perfect, set me off so that I could do PT, and I said, well, what about this lump in my groin? And he wasn't concerned. So I just kind of continued on with my life. At another point, it got larger, and I went to my doctor, and I was diagnosed with bursitis after a CAT scan. And then I was playing tennis with a girlfriend, and I was starting to lose. I was doing power yoga, but I was starting to kind of...
Okay, we're almost out of time.
Okay,
Tessa.
I'm sorry. But so eventually she said, well, have you been looking at these articles in the New York Times? And you know, long story short, I saw that was me, and it turned out I had massive damage, massive deterioration of muscle, and the lump was so big that it was pressing up against my nerves, so that's why I couldn't feel any pain.
Oh, Tessa, I'm so sorry, and I hope that by now that is going to be taken care of. Barry Meyer, you can see how useful your articles have been. I thank you for those and wonder what last words you might say to people who are considering hip replacements.
Well, the first thing I say is what I say to friends, which is don't hesitate to do it if you need it. The second thing I would say is educate yourself. Read whatever you can about the outcomes and performance of the devices and have a informed discussion with your doctor about it. If he wants to rush, go see another doctor. Find a doctor who's willing to sit down with you and explain to you why he is using a particular device in you and what's the data that he's basing that decision upon.
Good advice. Barry Meyer, staff reporter for the New York Times, Sarah Brown, Dr. Henry Boucher, Diana Zuckerman, earlier Kenneth Thorpe of Emory University. Thanks to all of you.
Thank you, Diane.
Thank you, Diana.
Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and